talk. So Bill received his PhD from Princeton and completed postdoc at Birkbeck College and University of California at Berkeley. He then became an assistant professor at McMaster before moving to the University of British Columbia, where he's been ever since. So he's done work on a wide variety of topics in quantum physics, gravitation, and cosmology, including his famous work on the Unruh effect, which bears his name, and has won a wide variety of prizes and awards, and was named a fellow of the Royal Society. So let's welcome Devin.
Thank you. I never know what I'm supposed to do when I come talking to you guys, so I will mumble along for a while, telling you a little bit about my history and perhaps trying to draw some lessons from that for you and your own careers. You, of course, will then promptly go ahead and ignore it all, which is exactly what you should do. One of the first things that I got interested in way back when, I was a student of John Wheeler's, and at that time the whole issue of quantum mechanics and gravity was a particular issue that he was interested in, and as a result got all of his students interested in as well. And I started trying to think about some issues. And there was one question that really started to bug me. And that's the question of what is a particle? Now, we know in physics that Newton based his theory of the world, his theory of physics, primarily on the notion that everything in the world was basically made up of these little particles that went wandering around. We know we have his famous equation, F equals ma. And that really makes sense only for particles. What it does is it relates the external world, the force, to certain attributes of the object that you're thinking about. One of them is this property called mass, which is some constant associated with the part of, with the object. And the other one is the acceleration. Well, what's the acceleration? The acceleration assumes that you've got, you know, if this is time and this is space, that you've got some particular path that that thing follows, particular instances where it is. And if you take the second derivative of this with respect to time, of this curve with respect to time, you get the acceleration. So the whole core of his theory was an idea that the world was made up of these particles. His influence was so dominant that that remained the paradigm for 150 years or so. There were objections to this. There were counterclaims to this, in particular by Huygens and by Robert Hooke. Robert Hooke was a contemporary of Newton's and to some extent, I guess, an enemy of Newton's. You've all heard that famous phrase, you know, if I see farther than others, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants. Well, Hooke was a dwarf. So a large part of that, which sounds like a, you know, very magnanimous, generous phrase, was actually a barb at his rival. Newton was the far better mathematician. Hooke was probably a better experimentalist and had a lot of very good ideas. Anyway, particles won out until the 1800s, when with electromagnetism, it suddenly became clear due to various experiments, like the famous dot. If you take a ball bearing and you shine a light on that ball bearing from a pinhole, if you look right behind the ball bearing in the shadow, there's suddenly a bright spot. That bright spot is there because of interference of the light going past the ball bearing. One of the proofs, it was already there in Newton's time. Newton was very bothered by what are called the Newton rings, these that we now know are interference patterns for light from two plates that have a slight angle to each other, or if you will, a lens placed upon another lens. If you look just at the intersection point, you see these sets of rings there, which he floundered around giving all kinds of weird explanations for. And Huygens had explained in terms of waves, but this was all forgotten until the 1800s. Then you had, what are these so-called waves? Well, waves are really an example of something that Faraday then called fields, something which has values everywhere in space. At any instant of time, this field exists everywhere at once and has different values at different places. Those values could be zero, and interesting situations can arise where it's zero almost everywhere except in some small little region. But basically, it exists everywhere at all times. Something that's almost the exact opposite of a particle. A particle is something that has a specific existence at one point and nothing anywhere else. Well, there was a tension between the two of them. And that tension finally got resolved after Einstein's theory of special relativity and quantum mechanics, when it was realized that really special relativity and particle theories don't fit together. And the problem comes in the interactions between these particles. The only way in which you can really get a special relativistically invariant interaction between particles is if they occur at the same point. If that interaction occurs only when those two particles are sitting on top of each other. Well, the probability of two particles sitting on top of each other is zero. They're points. And you shoot two points at each other, and there's just no way that they're ever going to sit on top of each other. And so in the 1930s, it became realized that if we want to unify quantum mechanics and special relativity, we have to do something called quantum field theory. One had a classical theory, electromagnetism, as an example of a field theory. And throughout the late 1920s and through the 1930s, people struggled with trying to figure out how one could produce a quantum field theory. And with the realization that everything would have to become a quantum field theory. Now, some of you are looking probably a little puzzled and saying, but wait a minute. We're constantly talking about this whole field of physics called particle physics, right? It's actual nonsense. They don't do particle physics, they do field theory. But the notion of the world as consisting of particles is so strong that even now, 100 years later, we're still clinging onto that terminology in the imagination that this gives us a more of an intuition of as to what's going on. One of the problems that arises then in quantum field theory is what are particles? After all, when one does a cloud chamber experiment, one sees these little tracks of the alpha. How many of you see cloud chambers or bubble chambers? Maybe even made one? How many of you have made a cloud chamber? These, good. You see these little tracks of the particles that are obviously little particles. So how does one go from this quantum field theory, these things that exist everywhere at once, these things whose equations of motion are that the way in which the value of the field at this point changes is because of the influence of the other values of the field in the immediate vicinity, usually in terms of some sorts of partial differential equations. How in the world does one take the one and get the other? Well, in part, we know that quantum mechanics is a bit weird anyway, the whole wave-particle duality, which is usually expressed as if you have a particle, then that particle has this wave function associated with it, which makes it sort of seem as though it's spread out and so forth. But what we realize here is it's actually the opposite way around, that one has this field theory, and in certain situations, it acts as though it were a particle. It has a specific location, and it has specific tracks that it follows. Well, there were techniques developed in order to sort of make this link between particles and quantum field theories in the 1930s, 1940s, etc. And the idea was basically, well, look, any of these fields, especially if they're linear, if we're not worried about interactions, which is where one could get a definition of a particle all on its own, one can think about the modes of this field. We know that if we have a bunch of masses on springs, for example, they have certain modes of vibration. And for the simplest fields, those modes act exactly like simple harmonic oscillators. And we all know from our elementary quantum mechanics course that if you have a harmonic oscillator, the energy of that harmonic oscillator has discrete values. Harmonic oscillator has values of, you know, n plus 1 half h bar times omega, where omega is the angular frequency of that particular mode of vibration. So suddenly we've got something that looks like little lumps, right? The energy comes in these little discrete lumps. Well, particles come in little discrete lumps, so therefore this must have something to do with particles. So somehow these excitations of the modes are supposed to correspond to particles. Of course, these modes have a problem, and that they're everywhere at once. I mean, most of the modes that one writes down, we look like, you know, e to the I kx, for example. And that sure doesn't have any position. It's got unit magnitude everywhere in space. Doesn't look like something with a position. But we can sort of do Fourier transforms, and we know that if I take a Fourier transform, look something like this, that I can make a little wave packet, which has a finite extent in space. Well, here's something that's located somewhere in space, and it looks like a particle. So this was primarily the idea that then went on for the next n years. But when I was a graduate student, and well, actually after I was, when I was a postdoc, I really started worrying about this concept of what is a particle, because when one gets into general relativity, what the right modes are in order to build up these normal modes becomes very uncertain. In particular, because the gravitational field is, in general, time dependent. And these harmonic oscillators are supposed to be things that go as e to the I omega t. What in the world corresponds to these harmonic oscillators in this quantum field theory? Now, most people approach this from a point of view of mathematics. So in cosmologies, for example, where the universe is homogeneous everywhere, you can then think about doing a Fourier transform. There exist modes which are the same everywhere in space, just like the e to the I kx. One can do a Fourier transform using them and regard them as being sort of your harmonic oscillators. One finds that those modes, if you start them in the ground state, if one has the Hamiltonian, the energy for these particles, you start them in the ground state, you find that they get excited due to the time dependence of the background cosmology. In fact, it's really bad, because if you start them in the ground, if each of these modes, these oscillators, in their ground state, you find an infinitesimal time later that there are an infinite number of particles, excitations, with basically an infinite amount of energy at the next second instant of time. And so people floundered around a lot, I mean, especially Leonard Parker, developing ideas of sort of adiabatic notions of particles, where one didn't think about the state of no particles, which in the harmonic oscillator would be the ground state of the particle. Instead of that, you thought about, well, even if things change a little bit, I don't want too many particles to be created. So let's, instead of taking the ground state of the Hamiltonian or the energy at any instant, you shift that a little bit. And if you do that, you find that you don't get too many particles created as time goes along. But a lot of this is sort of a mathematical thing. And one of the problems I had was that I was really interested in black holes. And in black holes, one doesn't have this homogeneity. One doesn't know what the modes are of the system. So what can one try to do? Well, to some extent, this is reading, you know, one of the things about history is that history is always seen by us in the present. And one can very, very easily read back into history things that we only realized later. And to a certain extent, this next statement I make is going to be of that form. But I thought, okay, how does one, if one goes to an experimentalist and asks them what is a particle, what do they tell you? They don't whip out their pencil and start scribbling formulas on the tape, on the piece of paper. They call you over and point to their cloud chamber or something like that, or their Geiger counter or whatever, and say, there. That Geiger counter clicked, that's a particle. The cloud chamber had this little path in it, that's a particle. That's what I mean by particle. So, in the question of what is a particle, my answer was a particle is what a particle detector detects. Okay. It's sort of tautological. On the other hand, if we look at F equals ma, that's sort of tautological as well. What does m mean? What does f really mean? Etc. But it guides you where to look. So this tells us that in order to understand what a particle is, we've got to first understand what a particle detector is. And how does a particle detector work? Well, a simple little model of a particle detector might be a box with an electron or something inside that box in its lowest energy state. If now a photon comes along, that electron absorbs the photon and gets kicked up to a higher energy state. And here's the wave function of the electron in the box in its higher energy state. And there's a difference in energy between those two of delta E. So this particle absorbs lumps with energy delta E. That's the particle. That's a very simple model of a particle detector. If I find it's gotten excited, then I've detected a particle. If I find it hasn't gotten excited, well, that could either be because the particle detector hasn't been switched on very well, or the interaction is very weak, and I haven't waited long enough, or no particle has come by the detector. But here's a simple model of a particle detector that one can now use to try and answer the question of what is a particle. And if we take this particle detector and place it in flat space-time and just have it sit there in an electromagnetic field or something, and we put the electromagnetic field into its vacuum state, and we allow the detector to sit there for a while, we find it doesn't get excited. So this kind of detector behaves the way in which we expect it to do, namely, if there ain't any particles around, it doesn't click. That's surely a first, at least a minimal requirement. Similarly, one can take these modes and put the system into a one part, what's typically called a one-particle state, where one or the other of these modes, or some linear combination of those modes, is excited up into its first energy state, n equals 1, for that mode or for that set of modes. And we design these modes such that their Fourier transform is such that the particle actually passes by the detector. After all, I could build up these modes in such a way that my detector is sitting here and the particle goes shooting off there. I wouldn't expect it to click. It doesn't. But if those modes add together in such a way that that wave packet travels through the detector, then lo and behold, I discover that the detector has a probability of being excited proportional to its cross-sectional area, etc., the coupling constant of the mode, and so forth. So this thing really does behave like a particle detector. Okay. Now that I know what a particle is, something which makes this particle detector click, I can start playing games with my little detector. Yes.
Then you have to know what an electron is in order to make the detector.
Sure. Sure, this is like Einstein's rods and clocks, right? He defined his special relativity. He introduced this notion of what is a rod and what is a clock. Come on, those are physical objects. They're made up of the material that makes up the world. How in the world do you design these rods and clocks in such a way as to, you know, make special relativity consistent? Well, he just basically, it bothered him, but he basically said, look, that's for tomorrow. And people still work, I mean, trying to figure out what really is a clock and how one can make a compact object in quantum mechanics and so forth. In classical physics, it becomes virtually impossible. In quantum physics, you've got the possibility of building little objects that sit at some place, keep their length. How does a rod keep its length? Well, you get a bunch of little carbon and hydrogen and oxygen atoms that interact with each other, and their interaction is such that they like to be a certain distance apart. So you just pile them up one after the other, and there you have your rod. So we have these sort of little stories we can tell now as to what a rod and a clock is, but one of the things he said is, well, I'm not going to worry about that right now. Similarly here, I know I've got particle detectors. I know I can make a Geiger counter. So let's make the simplest Geiger counter I can. And I'm not going to worry about exactly how to do it in terms of quantum field theory. I'm just going to assume that I can do it because, after all, I know I can do it. And so let's just see where that leads. And I mean, it's a very interesting question. I mean, how can one build things together to really produce a particle detector? How does the Geiger counter really work? And what parts of it are really and what parts of it are superfluous? After all, how it really works, I would have to explain the color of it and the little dial paintings and so on. Come on, that's not important. Well, how do I know? So I built the simplest particle detector that I can and use it. Well, one of the things about black holes that we know is that in general relativity, gravity is not a force. I could give a little lecture on that. I've got a beach ball, but I don't have it long. The picture that you see of me downstairs on the visitors page have me standing behind my favorite little beach ball, which I use to explain how general relativity works in 10 minutes. But I'm not going to do that. Gravity is not a force. Therefore, as I'm standing here, what I feel under my feet is not this balance between gravity pulling me down and the earth holding me, stopping me from falling in, but is only the earth holding me up and accelerating me upwards. So in order to hold something at a fixed position, it has to be accelerated. And in particular, if one has a black hole, the closer one brings the object to the horizon of the black hole, the higher the acceleration has to be. So, one of the obvious questions to ask about this particle detector is, what happens if I accelerate it? Right? Not around a black hole, but even in flat space. So let's say I have the electromagnetic field in its ground state, in its vacuum state, so that a detector just sitting there won't see anything. Right? I said before, I tested out these detectors, and if I just have them sit there in this so-called, the thing that everybody calls the vacuum state of the electromagnetic field, it never clicks. But if there's no particles around, it doesn't see them. Of course, it had better behave like that. What happens if I accelerate it? Well, your first reaction is, okay, it better not click. There's no particles around. But it clicks. You can do the calculation of, it's a fairly straightforward calculation. Doesn't even need any renormalization or any of the techniques of quantum field theory. It's just sort of page 2 of your quantum field theory textbook. You just use that in order to do the calculation. And you find that this accelerated detector gets excited. It furthermore gets excited at exactly the rate that you would expect. This is a different T. Temperature equals acceleration over, and I can never remember my 4 pi's. I think it's 4 pi. Ralph, what is it?
2 pi.
2 pi, thank you. Times h bar divided by c times Boltzmann's constant. I.e., it clicks exactly as though it were in a thermal bath. It's a funny thermal bath, because also when you accelerate that detector, it's acting as if it were in a gravitational field, right? If you're in an elevator, you feel heavier. It's as though you're in a gravitational field. So we have this thermal bath that causes the detector to click. Well, how are we going to explain this? One way is to say, well, look, you know, you do this kind of quantum field theory calculation of the detector in it, and you find out it clicks. The other is to take this to heart. A particle is what a particle detector detects. So therefore, if I accelerate this particle detector and it clicks, it sees particles. For the accelerated detector, that space that, remember, I said was such that if I had the particle detector at rest, it would never click, and so therefore it would never see any particles. When I accelerate the detector, it sees particles. It suddenly sees the whole vacuum state that you thought you had built as being all full of particles. Obviously, the quantum field theory hasn't changed at all. And in fact, the state of the quantum field theory is exactly the same as it was before. It's the vacuum state. But the interpretation of that state in terms of particles has changed. Namely, what before you thought of as being a system with no particles in it suddenly becomes a system with all kinds of particles in it. The higher the acceleration, the more there are. Now, of course, this guy's a small number. This guy's a big number. He's a fairly big number. It takes an acceleration of something like 10 to the 23rd centimeters per second squared to give 1 degree Kelvin. 10 to the 23rd centimeters per second squared is a little bit high of an acceleration. Even your best muscle car is not going to get anywhere near that. So it's not surprising that people haven't seen this. You know, if you swing or if you throw something at your, it doesn't suddenly melt in your hands because you've been accelerating it. Temperature isn't high enough. On the other hand, because the molecules inside a steak behave just like this as well, you stick your steak into the microwave oven, how does that work? The molecules inside the steak absorb these excitations of the electromagnetic field, jump up to higher levels. When they decay, they cause the molecules to move back and forth more rapidly, and it heats up and cooks your steak. Since I just used this absurdly simple model to describe a particle detector, the steak acts like a particle detector. So if I stick a steak into this and I accelerate it sufficiently high, it's going to cook. And with these accelerations, it might be a bit squished as well. But that's just an engineering difficulty. This ties in with black holes, because if I think about a black hole, one expects the same kind of thing to happen. If one thinks, for example, about an observer falling into the black hole, and we require that that observer doesn't see much of anything as it falls into the black hole, that seems reasonable, especially at late times, where everything has settled down. The field right around the horizon is just a normal quantum field. So, you know, if there are no particles traveling out, coming out from the inside of the black hole, well, they can't get out through the surface anyway, but it should be roughly the vacuum state there. But if I now have a little particle detector in a box held just outside there, it should start clicking with a temperature. And one finds that that temperature, proportional to the acceleration, that temperature is in fact exactly the blue-shifted Hawking temperature. Hawking showed that if you have a black hole and you put this condition on it, namely that an infalling observer doesn't see much as he falls in, that then that black hole will produce radiation at far distances, which comes pouring out with a temperature proportional to 1 over the mass of the black hole. Well, it turns out that this acceleration temperature is precisely that temperature, blue shifted by the gravitational 1 minus 2m over r. That's the gravitational redshift formula. R is the distance that we are from the center. Well, that's not quite true. R is 1 over 2 pi times the circumference of the circle around the black hole, because measuring in towards the center doesn't mean very much. This is the so-called gravitational redshift factor. If we're going out, this is very small inside, gets bigger inside. The temperature turns out to be proportional to that 1 over m times 1 minus 2m over r. And as we get for r very near 2m, that turns out to exactly be the acceleration. So if one has particle detectors and one holds them at rest at various places, as you get closer and closer to the horizon, one finds that the Hawking temperature just smoothly goes over into this acceleration temperature. So from that point of view, one could say that the origin of the particles that produce Hawking radiation, which was one of the questions that I was really trying to understand, is just this acceleration temperature right near the horizon. On the other hand, wait a minute, this acceleration temperature is there because you accelerated the thing. If you don't accelerate it, you don't see you don't see much of anything there. Which is the right way of thinking about it? Is there lots of stuff near the horizon of the black hole, or isn't there? If one calculates the stress energy tensor near the black hole, i.e. the energy density, one finds that the energy density is not very big. As you come closer and closer, in fact, it turns out that the energy density, the energy looks as though there's this very, very small flux of radiation traveling out, which carries away positive energy. Well, that's what you'd expect. There are all these particles coming out in Hawking radiation. But as we come closer and closer, one sees a negative flux of energy going into the black hole. And that negative flux of energy is what shrinks the black hole. We can understand that from the point of view of flat space, because we know in flat space, an accelerated detector sees this temperature But obviously the quantum field doesn't have this diverging bunch of energy in it. After all, there could be an accelerating particle detector just going through right now. And just because there's the detector there, that's not going to produce this humongous amount of energy right here and now. It's more or less zero in the vacuum. So what that tells us is that these particles make the detector click and change the energy of the detector, but they don't at the same time change the energy of the space-time around it. In this case, in the black hole case, this is almost all true, except some of the particles escape out to infinity. They carry away energy, and so the particles near the black hole, which act as though they were coming out of the black hole and then falling back in, not all of them fall back in. So there's less energy falling in than there was before. Well, less than zero is negative. And so you get negative energy flowing into the black hole and positive energy flowing out. So this was sort of the story. I mean, as I said, some of this is accretion since that time. But this is sort of the story that I went through in trying to understand the what seemed like an absurdly simple question, is what is a particle? When one has a quantum field theory, in other words, take quantum field theory seriously, what we have in the world is quantum field theory. We don't have a particle theory. We're not doing particle physics. We're doing quantum field theory. So let's take that really seriously. But next, let's make sure we ask physical questions of that quantum field theory. Not necessarily mathematical questions, although the physical questions rapidly lead to mathematical questions. But one wants to ask physical questions. In this case, how do I define a particle? Well, I define a particle by particle detectors. That's at least tying the notion of what is a particle to something physical, namely the clicking of a Geiger counter or the tracks in a cloud chamber or something like that. So you want to take the mathematics extremely seriously and take seriously what the mathematics is telling you it's doing, in this case quantum field theory, not particle physics. And at the same time, trying to figure out what physical questions you can ask of that quantum, of that system. Not necessarily that those physical questions may lead you to mathematical questions, but that's necessary, but not sufficient. And what happened for most other people was that they would tend to ask mathematical questions of the quantum field theory, trying to see whether or not they could force the mathematics to look like their prejudices told them to, it should, you know, as to what a particle was and so forth. In this case, what one was trying to do was to ask this physical question and then use the mathematics to try and tell us what the answer to that was. And I think, you know, if there's any lesson to be drawn from, you know, what I did in this, that's sort of the lesson to draw. I think I'm more or less running out of time, so I won't go on to another subject. Instead, I will let you ask questions. Notice I haven't done any of the mathematics that I had to do in order to do this. I just assured you that it's actually very easy. Yes?
When you spoke of the black hole, you're talking about the stress energy tensor. Isn't that, are you talking about the vacuum expectation value of the stress energy tensor near the horizon? Or?
Right. So when I talk about what is the energy near the black hole, what I'm doing is I'm asking, what's the expectation value of the energy.
Okay.
If I, you know, usually of the energy momentum tensor,
right.
Just to make it more generic.
Right. But if you're approximating that by Rindler space, then wouldn't it just be zero like it is in fact?
Right. So Rindler space, I mean, if in just near this horizon, this looks very, very much like just an accelerated detector in flat space-time.
Right.
And for an accelerated detector in flat space-time, we know what the answer is.
Yeah. Okay.
We've calculated what the expectation value is of the stress energy tensor. It's zero.
Right. Yeah.
Right? It's not some diverging quantity proportional to the temperature to the fourth power. You know, usually, you know, Stefan Boltzmann's law says that E is sigma T to the fourth. That's not what we get for the energy of all these particles. Why does it happen? Well, it turns out that the vacuum state as seen by the detector, in other words, a state where there are no particles as seen by the detector, has a huge amount of negative energy. In this case, however, it's not quite the same. Because in the case of the flat space-time, all of the particles that seem to be coming out of the horizon because of the acceleration fall back in. Okay, they all bounce off the potential barrier and fall back in. Here, a few of the particles leak out. Not many. For a solar mass black hole, 1 kilohertz photon comes out about every microsecond.
Yeah, and the
that's not much energy. 1 1-kilohertz photon is, 10 to the minus 12 electron volts per second. That thing doesn't evaporate very rapidly. But that one carries away the energy. What we know is that the energy, if they had fallen back in from flat space-time, would have been zero. Well, now there's an empty place here because this guy escaped.
Right.
And therefore, the energy falling in must be less than zero, which is negative.
Okay.
And calculations show that, in fact, that there's a negative energy flux that flows into the horizon of the black hole, which is what decreases the mass of the black hole, and a positive flux that heads out to infinity.
Right, but another question. Sorry. When you say that there's this potential barrier that sort of has all the thermal radiation fall back in the Rindler horizon, the apparent horizon, here the same thing would be the potential barrier that's set up by the Schwarzschild or whatever.
Right,
gravitational
right.
Barrier.
So in this case, if one looks at the metric, one finds that, if one looks at any of the angular momentum modes, depending on what coordinates you do it in, but in some set of coordinates, it looks something like this. That there's a potential barrier. If it were flat space-time, in other words, if there were no curvature, this would keep going up to infinity. But it doesn't, and therefore a little bit of radiation leaks out over the top. The height of this potential is the same as has the same energy as the temperature if you're at very low angular momentum modes, and as you go up in angular momentum, that barrier gets higher and higher, and fewer and exponentially fewer particles get out. So almost all of the radiation from the black hole is in the lowest angular momentum mode. That leaks out. That means that those particles which should have gotten back in if this were flat space, don't. And that then gives you a negative energy flux back into the black hole. That also suggests that it's in this region here that in some sense the particles are created. They're not created at the horizon. At the horizon, this just looks like acceleration radiation. They're there because the detector is accelerated. It's somewhere around the top of the angular momentum barrier, which is out around r equals 3m, that the particles seem to be being created. This has led to huge confusions, by the way, even till now. You know, it's now, what is it, 40 years later? People still get confused and they say, wait a minute, this accelerated detector, he sees more and more of these particles, therefore the energy must diverge as you get nearer and nearer this horizon. Maybe that's enough to, in fact, stop the horizon from forming. You've got this infinite amount of energy there where the horizon shouldn't be there. And so you still get papers being published by people who suggest that black holes never form because of this quantum effect. Well, but wait a minute, that's just flat space. We know what flat space behaves like. It doesn't have infinite energy densities in flat space. Well, black holes are different from flat space. Yeah. Where's the difference? Yes. Yes.
What has your more recent work focused on?
One of the things that I've done more recently came out of the same kind of, in a sense, the same kind of idea. I had certainly, and I think most people had felt that, you know, what Hawking discovered was something that was very peculiar to black holes and black holes alone. Which made it tough to build intuition, because we don't have a good idea of quantum mechanics and gravity, and so one's constantly feeling that one's wandering through a swamp there. Back in 1972, which is infinitely far long away, except for me, which was when I was a postdoc in London, Dennis Sharma invited me to Oxford to give a colloquium on black holes, and I was trying to think of how to explain black holes to an audience of physicists. The name itself had only been invented about 5 years earlier by John Wheeler. People didn't know about black holes. They hadn't become the big popular thing by then yet. And I thought, how can I sort of give a feeling for them? And the little analogy that I came up with was, let's assume we've got a waterfall, and this waterfall is particularly virulent such that at one point, the velocity of water is equal to the velocity of sound. I conveniently never calculated how big the waterfall would have to be in order for that to happen. I've recently done that, and the waterfall would have to be about 10,000 kilometers high. But it's just an engineering difficulty. Let's imagine that we're on a world in which the velocity of sound is much lower. Then if we're outside, sound waves are going to, you know, travel slightly slower in that direction than in this direction because the water sweeps them over the waterfall. But if a sound is emitted just here, it gets swept over at the same rate as it's trying to climb out, and it never gets out. So this system looks in many ways like a black hole, only it's now a black, or what I call a dumb hole, from deaf and dumb, not stupid. It's a dumb hole. In other words, it can't speak. No sound can get out of it. So this was a little analogy that I had, which was sort of fun to put in a colloquium. And about 8 years later, I, for my sins, I was given a fluid mechanics course to teach. And one day while preparing lectures, I thought about this analogy again, and I thought, well, let me try and do some further calculations. And I did the calculations for sound waves on this background flow and found out that they obeyed exactly the same equation as, let's say, light, or in particular scalar fields did, in a background geometry. this background fluid flow defines a kind of geometry which has a horizon in it, just like a black hole does. Furthermore, one can go through Hawking's calculations step by step and find that this thing actually produces thermal radiation. In this case, not proportional to 1 over the mass of the black hole. That, of course, wouldn't make any sense. Water keeps pouring in, more and more mass, and yet the horizon stays the same. But in this case, proportional basically to the rate of change with distance of the velocity of the fluid just at the point where the velocity is equal to c. So the temperature in this case is proportional again to some geometrical factor, which is just the rate of change of the velocity just at this horizon. This gives us the possibility of possibly doing experiments. One of the problems with black holes is you can't do experiments with them. We don't have any small black holes on Earth, and if we had, we wouldn't want them. They're a bit too voracious. Or if they're small enough, they're a bit too hot and would fry us, so you keep them away. But that, of course, makes it extremely difficult to do experiments. On the other hand, flowing a fluid, oh, come on, we do that all the time. And we can imagine, you know, we have wind tunnels in which you go supersonic and all of that kind of stuff. One can imagine setting up an experiment like this. So one of the things that people have become interested in is trying to do experiments like this. A group at UBC did an experiment like this, in which we looked at the stimulated emission instead of the spontaneous emission. Now, Einstein taught us that spontaneous emission is closely related to stimulated emission. If you know what the stimulated emission is, you know what the spontaneous emission rate is. And showed that this, in fact, the stimulated emission implies that the spontaneous emission would have a temperature roughly proportional to that. Roughly, it was actually very difficult to figure out exactly where the horizon was in order to calculate that. But what we showed was that it was a beautiful thermal spectrum. So the system produced a thermal spectrum with a temperature which was approximately the right value. So that's one of the things we're interested in. And one of the things people are interested in is, for example, perhaps doing experiments where you could actually see the spontaneous emission. That's a lot harder. In our experiment, the spontaneous emission rate would have had a temperature of 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin. Well, Vancouver water is a little bit warmer than that. You know, Ontario water sometimes. But so that's pretty hard to do in water. But people have made suggestions. Probably the closest to being realized is you can actually make a sort of a traveling black hole in, for example, materials. If you have a material like glass, well, glass turns out not to be the best, but anyway, you could have a pulse of light traveling, or if you want, a complete pulse of light traveling in here in such a way and such that it's strong enough to change the refractive index in here so that the velocity of light inside here is slower than the velocity of the pulse. Or at least in certain frequencies is slower than the velocity of the pulse. Now you have a black hole horizon here and a white hole horizon here, both of which would emit should emit thermal radiation. And there are a number of groups doing that. There was a group that did this in glass. The problem was the intensity of the pulse was such that if you increased it just a little bit, you started hearing the glass go, i.e. the pulse was actually destroying bits and pieces of the glass as it was traveling through the glass. That's liable to produce all kinds of radiation, which you don't want. The proposal now is to do this in a lump of diamond. And in fact, they bought nice pure single crystal diamond. He told me it was unfortunately only about 4 millimeters by 4 millimeters. By 1 millimeter, so it's not a huge lump of diamond, but in principle, one could get a lump of diamond this size. It would just cost a bit of manufactured diamond, in which it should be able to tolerate much higher intensities of light, and they're proposing doing experiments like that. That's probably the closest. Others have suggested doing this in Bose-Einstein condensates, where one of the advantages is that the velocity of sound is very low, millimeters per second. But that's a huge disadvantage because it turns out that the temperature is proportional to the velocity of sound squared. I never remember these factors. Have to recalculate them every time I do them. Anyway, it's proportional to the velocity of sound. So with a low velocity of sound, that means the temperature is very low. So Bose-Einstein condensates, the best that you could do is a temperature of about 10 to the minus 12 are the estimates. However, for Bose-Einstein condensates, unlike water in Vancouver, the temperature of the BEC is down around 10 to the minus 11, and maybe you could get it down to 10 to the minus 12. So you're actually in a regime where you might actually be able to see the spontaneous emission. So it's questions like that that I'm looking at. Again, taking a quantum field theory, in this case sound waves in a background flow, and asking physical questions of it, asking how is this similar to the other system, namely black holes, that we want to understand. And so one hopes that one can use this analog in order to understand what's going on in the black hole. Understand where the particles are created, stuff like that. And that you can do both theoretical work and experimental work on it, potentially. So that's what I'm working on now. People have also suggested that maybe one could see acceleration radiation. Unfortunately, the straightforward stuff, namely if you imagine building a little detector, let's say a two-level atom, or inside the BEC, which you accelerate, it doesn't work because the atom itself doesn't suffer the relativistic time dilation. And that turns out to be an essential part of the way in which a detector works in flat space-time. However, one can imagine doing the circular analog, and Bell and Linnaeus in the 80s and then I in the 90s showed that there are close similarities between linear acceleration and very high circular accelerations. And so perhaps one could take something like this inside the BEC, rotate it very rapidly, and see whether or not that detected the sound waves inside that BEC and have a direct detection of this kind of acceleration radiation. So there's links back to the acceleration radiation as well. Yes?
So are you suggesting that the spontaneous emission near the black hole is not a property of quantum gravity? But
right. It's purely classical gravity, and somehow or other that produces this instability in the quantum fields that are sitting near the horizon, which produces this thermal radiation. Now, once one starts worrying about the back action of that quantum radiation, you have to start worrying about quantum gravity type effects. So, you know, how does the black hole grow smaller? Well, for a big black hole, this is such a slow process, you know, 10 to the minus 12 electron, or 10 to the minus 8 electron volts per second. That's just so little, for a solar mass black hole, that's just so little energy that everything is going adiabatic, and you should be able to pretend that there's a very nice geometry at all times. On the other hand, if the black hole starts to get very small, of the order of the Planck scale, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, a little bit bigger than that, then quantum gravity effects and this back action would become crucial. So it plays a role, but this is sort of a first step where quantum gravity effects are not the most important thing as far as the thermal emission is concerned. Other things, yes, but not as far as the thermal emission itself is concerned. The hope, of course, is that you know, it at least links quantum mechanics and gravity, and so will give us some clues as to what an ultimate theory of quantum gravity behaves like. That's the hope. But people are still playing around with that hope. Yes?
When you said before that it took you a while to come to your statement of what a particle is, and I don't think I would have come to that statement myself because it's kind of hard to figure out. What did you think of before then? Like, how did you get to that point?
In a sense, it was something like that, because I was really concerned with what in the world do I mean, but if I'm near this black hole, you know, or not in a cosmological space-time, what do I mean by a particle? You know, how am I going to define particles there? And my idea was, okay, let me put a detector there and see how it responds and define the particle in a sense in terms of the detector, at least play with that, okay? So this was the idea I had. And then when I actually did the calculations, I showed that, in fact, it had this thermal character that the accelerated particle detector, even in flat space-time, responded thermally. And therefore also, you know, you could then see the link in the black hole case between the Hawking radiation and the horizon, etc. And so, you know, in the back of my mind, it wasn't stated as clearly as this, but that was the idea that was floating around in the back of my mind. Let's see how a particle detector behaves. And maybe that will give us a little clue as to how I can define particles when I'm very near the black hole. Yes.
So when I'm accelerating particles, usually I have to inject like work and energy into it. So where is this, I guess, extra energy coming from, allowing the temperature to increase?
The acceleration, I mean, you've got to exert a force on this particle detector. That force changes when the mass of the detector changes. In order to keep the acceleration the same, the force on the detector has to change. That feeds in energy into the system. So it's from that kind of a balance of systems. Pardon?
So it's actually from the experimental apparatus.
Right, so the experiment, I have to accelerate this detector, which requires a force, right? That force is doing work. So it is feeding energy into the system. The mass of the system is changing as this, you know, as it absorbs the energy from the quantum field. Therefore, the amount of work fed in changes depending on whether it gets excited or not. And somehow in that intersection is where the energy is where the energy balance is coming from. Yes?
Could you maybe flesh out how this definition you give of a particle, which seems nice, actually sort of works out. So, I mean, maybe here you were talking about some kind of simple, like, I don't know, a free scalar field or something there. So could you flesh out how you really put a particle detector in and see particles, and therefore this is a, you know, series?
Sure.
Yeah.
The simplest example, I mean, this was the example I came up with. Bryce DeWitt came up with a simpler example, which he called a monopole detector. And the argument is that you have a two-level system, and you've got, in this case, a scalar field. It's supposed to be the field theory, the quantum field theory. You now ask, okay, so there's a coupling now between the quantum field, but that coupling only occurs at the location and at the time. That tau is the proper time of the detector. So t is some function of tau, x is some function of tau. This is basically cinch, and that's cosh of tau with acceleration thrown in there. So the coupling looks like, and then you have the raising plus lowering operators, i.e. this is the one that takes you from the ground state to the first excited state. This is what takes you from the first excited state to the ground state. You need both of them in there so that this is a Hermitian operator, not a non-Hermitian operator, which wouldn't, you know, which are nasty things. Physical things are supposed to be Hermitian. If we're working in the Heisenberg representation, this thing goes as e to the, I never get the signs right, so let me just give them. So that's what the interaction looks like. So now I can expand this scalar field in terms of the usual annihilation and creation operators. Let me get these guys right. A e to the I omega t, e to the I k x, k dot x, plus a dagger k e to the minus I omega t, e to the I k x, e to the minus I k x, integrated over k. This is what the quantum field looks like. This is what the interaction with the particle detector looks like. If it's going to be excited, it's got to be this guy. I'm doing, taking the integral over proper time, so I get an e to the plus I e tau here times e to the minus I e tau there. That gives us the excitation rate. Sorry, these should all be t of tau. And I've actually got my signs wrong here. So if this thing is just at rest, then tau is just the same as t. When I take this integral over tau, it's going to pick out only this term. Right? E to the plus I omega t times e to the I e t, that's going to be a rapidly oscillating function. When I integrate over t, that's going to go to zero. So if I apply this on the vacuum state, the only term that survives is this one, but that annihilates the vacuum. So that tells us the interaction is such that if it's in its ground state and you want to excite it, it's not going to get excited. Now, on the other hand, if I make this e to the t of tau, so this becomes cosh of a tau, and this chi becomes sinh of a tau. Now we're going to get a non-zero factor between this term and this term as well. It looks ugly because I've got exponentials of coshes and so forth. And there turn out to be tricks that one can play in order to actually do that evaluation. But the important thing is that it picks up terms like this, which tells you that the quantum field operating on the vacuum is no longer zero. So therefore, there's a probability for the particle detector to actually be excited.
Could you give a reference for this? Like somewhere where this is written down?
Pardon?
Could you give a reference for this? Like where this thing you just wrote down, for example, was written down?
Yeah, my paper, this is where it was originally, which was Physical Review D, volume 14. Was it 1976? And it's been done innumerable times since then. It turned out to be all kinds of tricks that one can play in order to do these, actually evaluate these integrals, but that's just mathematics. Of course, if you don't know the tricks, the mathematics is a complete stopper. And I was lucky that I thought of at least one of those tricks in order to be able to do those integrals. Turns out to be exactly the same kind of integral that Hawking had to do in the case of the black hole. Yes?
What is the type of thing that you could hope to learn about the black hole situation from an experiment, one of the sound experiments you were describing?
Right. Okay. One of the key things in the case of the black hole is that if you look at the calculation for the black hole, you find out that the reason for the stimulated emission coming out, you know, now, is because of vacuum fluctuations which have been, I'll call it, amplified by the black hole during the course of the evolution of the black hole. This is typical of spontaneous emission from many systems. Any linear amplifier has quantum noise in it because of exactly the same process. The problem is that in the black hole case, if I look at the radiation coming out now, I ask, where did it come from? Well, it came from closer to the black hole. Well, where'd that come from? Well, still closer. But it can never go inside the black hole, because the black hole is that surface out of which nothing can ever come. So this radiation, which I'm looking at now, must have come from quantum fluctuations closer and closer and closer to the horizon, exponentially squeezed against the horizon. And they keep being exponentially squeezed until they fall, exponentially squeezed until finally you get back to the time when the black hole was formed. Well, for a solar mass black hole, if you wait 1 second, that's an exponential squeezing factor of e to the 10 to the fifth. E to the 10 to the fifth is a very big number. A frequency of 1 kilohertz now is e to the 10 to the fifth kilohertz. Well, I don't even have to put in kilohertz. I can take h bar times the mass of the whole universe, and it's still e to the 10 to the fifth, because the difference between 1 kilohertz and the mass of the whole universe, h bar, you know, the mass of the universe divided by h bar, is only going to change that factor of 10 to the fifth by something like 10 to the third. And that's tiny. You know, 10 to the fifth minus 10 to the third is 10 to the fifth. So the vacuum fluctuations initially are humongous energy. Obviously, I don't believe the theory at that point. So therefore, one has real doubts about the applicability of the theory that Hawking used to calculate. In the case of sound waves, on the other hand, there are natural cutoffs. You can't have sound waves whose wavelength is shorter than the interatomic spacing. And therefore, the frequency is some regular frequency. Does the sound system still produce the thermal radiation? Even though its high frequency behavior is very different than the Hawking case, the low frequency behavior isn't. So if you see the thermal emission, that tells you that the Hawking effect really is a low frequency effect. It really doesn't care about the high frequency sector of the theory at all. Right? So that gives us a clue as to how one should start thinking about the Hawking effect. It's not something going on at ultra-high frequencies, a Planck or multi-Planck scale. It's something that's really happening down at low frequencies. And how can one understand this instability around the black hole at these very low frequencies is where it points one to. So one of the things that doing the experiment would do would give us confidence in the robustness of the effect. Namely, it doesn't really matter what the physics is at high frequencies. We're always going to get this effect. Or if there are deviations, we can then try and understand what those deviations imply to where these particles are being created. It strengthens my view, for example, that the particles are being created out around R equals 3m. They're not something coming out of the horizon. There's something that's happening well outside the black hole, you know, twice the diameter of the black hole or something like that. So well outside the black hole, that's where these particles are being created. So that's the kind of things that one would expect to learn from, you know, doing some experiments like this, i.e. that the phenomenon really is something that physically is robust, that isn't, you know, that doesn't really rely on all of these approximations one made in order to calculate it, a la Hawking and so forth. Sometime you're going to have to call it quits, but yes.
You're talking about Hawking's original derivation where he considered the geometric optics sort of approximation where you'd have really, really high frequency modes. And...
Right. Well, yeah. All calculations with the black hole really are of that same order.
Yeah.
I mean, some people argue that you can do these analytic continuations, but we know that analyticity is an incredibly powerful statement. Right, a function which goes as e to the minus e to the plus x squared, right? Well, that's zero almost immediately, right? I mean, it's just so tiny that it's absolutely zero. Now do the analytic continuation to plus, and suddenly the thing is blowing up on you, right? As the same kind of e to the whatever. So saying that the thing is analytic means that even things that look tiny at high frequencies become huge in the analytic continuation. So as soon as you imply analyticity, you're making very strong assumptions about the behavior of the theory out to arbitrarily high frequencies. So that doesn't really get you around the problem either. Now there are certain ways of doing the analytic calculations that, you know, can avoid this, you know, sort of WKB kind of approximations and so forth that you can do to sort of show where the Hawking effect is coming from. But certainly the naive calculation, the fact that as if you go to if you do the analytic continuation to imaginary time, which Hawking really loved, is making incredibly powerful assumptions about the behavior of the theory in itself that are as powerful as, you know, assuming the theory is still valid as at e to the e to the 10th to the 5th. Some of this I'm going over very quickly, so I'm sure some of you are. Mm-hmm.
Thank Professor Unruh again.